From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Americans on the whole have a growing intolerance for discrimination, except when it comes to judging people's accents. Although data collected by OkCupid, Babbel, and YouGov find the Southern accent the most appealing, even sexy, of regional dialects, it is still the butt of caricatures and jokes. Writer Laura Relyer explored her relationship to her own North Carolina drawl for the Bitter Southerner podcast. And that story of trying to lose it when her family moved to Chicago got a flood of responses on social media. She's with us from Athens to talk about the nerve her story landed on. Laura, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And you, in the story, pinpoint exactly when you began to lose your Southern accent. When was that?
We moved to Chicago when Michael Jordan had first returned to the Bulls. So,
so that places it for everyone.
Everyone remembers that moment. We were so excited to go there, but I was met with ridicule in my fifth grade class. It was just that first day I opened my mouth and assumptions were voiced and I got quiet.
What kind of assumptions?
Mostly, it was a really diverse class. It was actually kind of amazing. Mostly Filipino, Indian, and Pakistani children, along with African American children and some Caucasian children like myself. And they just assumed I was racist because I said y'all and mama and all the things that I said, which was stunning to me. I had never really thought about racism before, which I recognize as a privilege. But in Charlotte, I had just as diverse a group of friends as I ended up having in Chicago. But they just assumed otherwise. So,
well, here you are talking about it. This is from the Bitter Southerner podcast.
For months, I didn't speak in class unless called upon. Mostly, I kept to myself and sat in the back, hovered over my textbooks, listening. At lunch, I fumbled with my bubble packet of milk, ate my turkey sandwich, and studied the way my classmates spoke. Rough, not roof. Pop, not Coke or Coca-Cola. Mom, not mama. Each linguistic sacrifice pained me, but if I was going to make a life for myself in Chicago, I had to assimilate.
So you set about to assimilate, but you were just 10 years old then. What does it mean for you as you were growing up?
As soon as we started to move back, so my father was in the military and then just had jobs that moved him around a lot. So we were in Chicago for about 3 years. And as soon as we started moving our way back towards the Mason-Dixon line from Chicago, I realized what I had lost and what I had given up. But when you're 10, you don't really know that. You just, you know, you want to assimilate, especially like on the eve of lots of other hormonal changes. It's just easier to try and fit in, mm-hmm, instead of hold your ground. So I was really sad afterwards when I realized what I'd done, what I'd pained to do.
But this led to this whole exploration on accents that you wrote about for the Bitter Southerner podcast a couple years ago. Now it's finding new life on the podcast. Loads of responses on our private Facebook group, so we can't really quote those. But can you generalize what kind of responses you got? What were people saying?
Oh, it's been so fun. On the happy side, it just seems that people really love to talk about the way that they talk. So I've learned all kinds of new phrases and people just sharing very specific words to their hometowns or those kinds of things. But then on the flip side of that, I've had a lot of people reach out to me who are kind of Southern expats as well, who experience the same kind of sociolinguistic discrimination that I experienced, which was eye-opening for me and seems to be eye-opening for a lot of other people, especially folks who move north with a Southern accent.
Well, what kind of assumptions get made? This is Gwen Mullins writing on the Bitter Southerner. I did not want to sound Southern because to me, those adjectives, poor, ignorant, racist, Southern, were inextricably linked. And true, where and how I lived in those years, such traits were often shades of the same spectrum. So, Laura, how does how someone talks mark a person as a certain type of person? And why would, you know, what is involved in letting that go, I guess, is the best question.
you know, just from being judged by the way I sounded, I'm no sociolinguist, but just not assuming anyone's education level or wealth or anything by the way that they sound is, you know, it's hard to do. Sometimes you hear people before you see them. But it just leads you to, you know, not make those kinds of assumptions. My work led me to a professor at NC State named Walt Wolfram, who is essentially a knight in the state of North Carolina because he's done so much for the Southern accent. And his work has done a lot to kind of break down those barriers and assumptions that people have made over
This is Walt Wolfram. He's a linguist at North Carolina State. He heads up the North Carolina Language and Life Project, working to debunk misperceptions that we make based on accents. Here's a recording that they made, the center. This is Marvin Popcorn Sutton from this documentary project called Mountain Talk.
Talking about like that, like if you had some wood out in the yard, instead of saying carry it in the house, you'd say tote it in the house. And like if you had something that you wanted to put in a paper bag, you put in a paper poke, you know, instead of a paper bag.
Well, what does hearing that conjure up, if not a stereotype? I mean, how is this helping? How is that work helping?
He actually, that man who was speaking went on to be on Moonshiners, so I'm not sure.
He did just fine.
He did just fine. That was a really great example of an Appalachian accent or Appalachian, depending on where you are.
Yes, there you go. There's another one of those things.
Yeah, it's one of those things. One thing that I learned was that there are like seven different dialects just in the state of North Carolina, and there's probably just as many in the state of Georgia. And you can really pinpoint where someone's from based on how they say specific things or on things like paper poke. Like, that's specifically something that you hear in the mountain regions of North Carolina and not something that you would hear in Ocracoke, like on the coast, or in Charlotte, where I was. You definitely probably wouldn't hear it in Atlanta. And so that was what was beautiful to me, was how specific you could get depending on what you heard people say and phrases that they used.
I'm speaking with the writer Laura Relier about trying to lose and then regain the Southern accent of her childhood. She wrote about it in an article called Withdrawal as a Bitter Southerner contributor, and then talked about it recently for the Bitter Southerner podcast. But I guess, you know, the question there is about guessing where somebody's from or what their education level is. Like, I grew up in New Hampshire. My dad was from Boston, and he insisted that, you know, we use R's, unlike most people in Boston, you know, pack the cat kind of thing. And it was aspirational, you know, in a way it was achieving, I guess it would be called broadcast English. And the whole idea that it is limiting if you can be pegged to be from a certain place. You know, now that there are all these jobs in the North Carolina tech industry or, you know, hotels supporting this booming economy, is the idea that regionalism somehow makes you less marketable? I mean, as we said, Popcorn did just fine because he's on a reality TV show.
That's a great question. I think maybe the misperception, and this is just, I'm just guessing, I'm not a linguist, like I said, but maybe it's just that people don't think you're very worldly because you sound like you've been in the same place your whole life if you have a very specific regional accent. I could see that being the assumption. My mom was from Boston, too. There are words I didn't even know had R's in them until I reached adulthood. so I get that. And it was something that it was a perception that I put upon myself to correct, but I could see that people make judgments based on that, and they just assume that you've never been anywhere or you don't have an education because you haven't traveled much or something.
So a number of people on Facebook said that they were worried about not being taken seriously when they speak with a Southern accent. And maybe there's a little sexism there, too. You know, there's a lot of commentary about how women often speak down, you know, do the sort of vocal drag, especially. So there's a kind of whole thing about, you know, assimilation. And there's a bit from First Language. This is another North Carolina Language and Life documentary. This is on the Eastern Cherokee people's experiences with assimilation and preserving their language. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
We were not allowed to speak our language in school. We were banned from it.
People would tell us, you know, you have to learn the white man's way. And that's even including the language.
So this is extreme forced assimilation. And language assimilation continues to be a flashpoint in American politics. You know, many people say you come to America, you learn English, you go all in, you erase your accent. So where has your linguistic exploration brought you to on this point?
I think it's heartbreaking. The Cherokee language is a great example of how extreme we can get with that. And that wasn't, you know, the Cherokee Nation, that specifically was something that happened in North Carolina. But I've interviewed and spoken with other folks who are, you know, from the Mohawk tribe, which is actually in New York and in the upper region, northeast regions of the United States and Canada, and other places where it is, we force our culture upon other cultures and tell them to assimilate as if it, one's better than the other. I think that probably happens with a lot of immigrants coming into the United States. They're forced to forget their language and teach their children to only speak English or only speak English in the home. And that's just awful. The sacrificing your culture and sacrificing the community that it brings you is too much to ask of an individual or a group of people. And it homogenizes us. And if you lose that spectrum of personality, then and there's no diversity at the table, then we're stripped of our breadth and our depth. And that's too much.
So language as something that, I guess, expresses the soul. We're up against a break, but we want to keep you with us, certainly. Especially the fact that so many women made these comments that they were judged. Do you think there's something else going on here, a gender dynamic?
I could see that. When I think about the standard American news accent, I think of Walter Cronkite, I think of Peter Jennings, I think of the people who were set up to speak for the American people are traditionally white men. And yeah, there's probably a lot to unpack there, but I know we're against the break. That's another form of discrimination of many, many kinds that are out there in our country and around the world today.
We're going to continue our conversation with Laura Relier about accents, assumptions, and identities after a short break. And we would, of course, love to hear your thoughts. Do you feel like you have ever been judged for having a Southern accent or any other kind of accent? You can go to our Facebook group. We're at Facebook, GPB's On Second Thought, or we're at OST Talk on Twitter. We'll be right back. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Laura Relier. She spoke with our colleagues on the Bitter Southerner podcast about her exploration of the meanings and judgment and preservation of the Southern drawl, beginning with her own. It triggered a lot of responses and conversations about accents in contemporary America. Laura, I'm remembering a couple years ago, there was a story. This is Oak Ridge Labs in Tennessee. It's a federal research facility, lots of educated scientists, and they're planning a 6-week accent reduction course to help people feel more confident in meetings when you need to speak with a more neutral American accent. That's the quote. It got canceled due to loads of complaints, but this was about confidence. So in your work, you know, in your exploration for this story and speaking with Walt Wolfman and his colleagues at the lab, what about that idea that your confidence will be increased if you speak differently?
Well, I wish I'm so happy to hear that was canceled. I feel like a lot of good Southerners probably threw out a number of good bless your hearts at those folks. It shouldn't have to be that way, should it? I think like we were talking before the break, you know, there's just this perception that if you're going to be taken seriously in the workplace, you need to sound like Walter Cronkite. But that shouldn't have to be the case at all. And I think that, you know, sociolinguistic discrimination, Walt Wolfram at the NC State Language Institute asserts that sociolinguistic discrimination is the most prevalent kind of discrimination that there is. We're just not cognizant of it because it's not something that we can see, and we're a very visually driven society. But I tend to agree with them, and I feel like, you know, if we tune into those cues and we listen for the way that we're listening and the way that we assume and listen or, you know, observe discrimination happening in real time and kind of fight for and lobby for people to sound like what they sound like in every arena of life, then that's the only way that it will correct itself.
So in the piece you write about after dropping y'all when you moved to Chicago, rediscovering it, what was that moment like for you?
Well, nothing like Atlanta traffic to just make you start slinging words. My first return to y'all was in a bed of expletives during my morning commute.
Right. Things you can't say on the radio.
Things I cannot say on the radio, but it immediately stopped me the second it came out of my mouth, naturally. I mean, it's one of those things that I'd been trying to reincorporate into my patterns of speech, but it sounded really forced, and then y'all happened, and I stopped swearing and was just like, oh my goodness, I just said y'all, and then I think I called like three friends, because this was before the no phone law, and just to be like, oh my gosh, I said y'all, and it sounded normal. It was a joy. I wish more of it would come back to me, but I remember that was a really big personal moment.
So that idea that this is something that, you know, if we woke you up in the middle of your sleep, you might say y'all, but there was this whole disconnection from what you're trying to present in the world for a long time. Now, Laura, you have a 2-month-old son. Do you want your son to have a Southern accent?
Oh, heavens, yes. Yes, 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 yes. We were actually living up north, and that was one of the reasons that we moved back south. We wanted to raise our son in the South. And of course I want him to have an accent. I think I said this on the podcast. My father-in-law sounds like a Southern Garrison Keillor, and my mother-in-law is from Mississippi, and it's beautiful. My husband's grandfather has that really specific old Macon accent that you just don't hear anymore. And it's just so rich, and it's a rarity these days. I hope that he has a Southern accent. I will do my best to surround him with people with good thick drawls to try and help make that happen. but I won't force it on him because that's not my choice.
Laura Relier, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That is the writer and Bitter Southerner contributor, Laura Relier. You can listen to more of her story. It's on the Bitter Southerner podcast. It's a collaboration between GPB and the Bitter Southerner magazine. There are many episodes of the podcast and more of Laura's writing at bittersoutherner.com. And you can subscribe to all of it for free, all of our podcasts at gpb.org/podcasts.